Welcome back to Stack Trace. John, can you hear that?
Yeah, I can. What is that?
It's the ice cream truck. It's bringing all the scoops.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, we got some really big scoops, so we better have an ice cream truck to deliver them, right?
Oh, yeah. I love ice cream.
Yeah, me too. It's the best. Is that why you're always producing so many scoops, Rambo? Because you love ice cream?
Yeah, partly. So how are you doing, John?
I'm doing great. I realized today that it's been 3.5 months since I went indie. So I was thinking a little bit about it. I tweeted about that, you know, I'm very happy. I feel like it's one of the best decisions I've ever made to actually go indie and work full time with, you know, creating content with Swift by Sundell, with this show, with building developer tools. It's been so much fun, and I'm really enjoying my new indie life, and I feel like it's going really great, like really above expectations, and it feels good so far as well. So, yeah, thumbs up on the indie life.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm happy with my current arrangement as well, doing the part-time thing. It's working really well for me. It aligns itself very well with the show schedule. We record on Tuesdays. And aligns well with all the other stuff I have to do. But I am really overwhelmed with stuff to work on at the moment.
Yeah.
So I am taking advantage as much as possible of all the time I have, including weekends.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you have to push a little bit extra. And I definitely agree that it's really tricky, you know, especially when you are indie and you have all this time that you could use on anything, to actually decide what to work on and what to kind of, you know, focus on can be really, really tricky. And that's definitely been a huge challenge for me during these couple of months, to try to find that good balance between how much time do I spend writing articles, how much time do I spend making podcasts, how much time do I spend on open source, and also on new projects, and just like general, you know, trying out new technologies, research, and things like that. So even though you have a lot more time, it doesn't just automatically mean that things happen, right? you need exactly. To actually make the best use of that time, like you say as well, like to really make sure that you spend it on the right things.
Yeah. And of course, always there's the issue of burnout, which comes up a lot.
Yeah.
But just to make our listeners be assured, I'm not even close to that. I have plenty of time to watch movies and walk and do everything I like. So yeah, I'm far from that. I'm just working a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Taking enough breaks is definitely really important. And I don't usually follow, like, for the last couple of years even, I haven't even been following, like, this traditional hours of working, like, you know, 9 to 5 during weekdays, and weekends are your time for resting. Like,
but we love 9 to 5.
We do, that's right. We do love 9 to 5. But in this context, I feel like having this more flexibility of when to work also is very powerful, where I don't necessarily need to work, you know, those specific hours. And sometimes I will work during weekends, but that just means I will take some time to rest some other day. And I'm fortunate enough also that my girlfriend has also a very flexible work setup. So sometimes we will just take like a Thursday and a Friday off, but then we might work, you know, on the Saturday, because it doesn't really matter, like, actually, you know, what weekday you do the work. What matters is that you find that nice balance between working efficiently and productively on the tasks at hand, but also having enough time to really recharge and rest. And this for me is extremely important. Like, I never want to get more things done just by working more hours, because I feel like that just makes the results suffer in the long run, where you, like you say, you kind of burn yourself out, you get stressed, you have too many things to do, and, you know, without rest, you can't think clearly, at least not me, I can't do that. So I really need my beauty sleep or my think sleep.
Yeah, our followers love to ask, do you ever sleep?
Right.
Both of us. I know both of us get that question a lot. And to each, again, the answer is, yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah, I love sleeping. It's the best. So that's kind of what I've been up to, just like, more indie stuff. I've been doing a lot of work on open source. I've been doing a lot of new experiments. I've been working on my book, working on my new website. I also recorded another podcast episode together with Apple, with Michael Ilsman from the Swift team, which was awesome. Super fun. Yeah, so that's going to come out next week as we record. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So a lot of things going on. And I also got myself an Apple Watch, which means that we can finally do our Apple Watch Series 4 review.
Yeah, that's awesome. And we're going to do that in just a bit.
Yeah, so tell me what you've been up to.
Yeah, so I've been doing Chibi Studio more than usual lately because we are reaching that point where we can almost launch a beta. So I'm doing like the little fixes here and there. But there was one kind of major feature I wanted to do before the beta. And you saw that, I sent it to you. I replicated the Memoji color slider for Chibi Studio because we really wanted a way for the users to be able to customize colors a little bit better rather than just choosing from a list of colors. But at the same time, we wanted something super simple. So it's not like a full-blown color picker with RGB values or anything like that. It's just a list a set of colors that the user can choose from, and when they pick a color, they get a slider where they can make the color darker or lighter, just like in the Memoji UI. And we think that's a good balance between power and ease of use for the type of app we're working on.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Because having that full 2D spectrum, right, of all the different colors, and you can even add like, the saturation and the light of the color and everything to the mix, like it becomes like a full-blown image editor at some point. And like you say, it's not very user-friendly. It's not really the ease of use that you might be going for. So I think the control that you've been working on, like just having the two dimensions to slide between different values is probably a really good idea.
Yeah, we are not a pro app by far.
Right, that's in Chibi Studio Pro.
Yeah, we do like having some quote-unquote pro features in the app, like being able to customize colors and some other things like transforms and stuff like that. But we prioritize the easy-to-use stuff. So we do plan on eventually having a full-blown color picker. That will be like a different mode of the color tool that we have. But yeah, the priority is to have the simple one in there. And another quote-unquote pro feature we want to add is lots of keyboard shortcuts for iPad.
Nice. That's awesome. That's a great idea because those are in general pretty easy to add. Like the API is really easy to use, at least for the basic use cases where you just want to, react to a keyboard press. So I feel like almost every app should try to at least implement some keyboard shortcuts for the iPad because as anyone who has used an iPad Pro with a keyboard knows, like especially if you're used to working on a Mac, having those keyboard shortcuts available, even if they're just basic ones, is such a huge productivity booster. So Rambo, it seems that you are mostly focused on Chibi Studio at the moment. Like that's your main programming outlet. That's what you're coding mostly on. But I also wanted to ask you like how you balance your time between like the spelunking activities that you do, because as we're about to talk about on this episode, you've been uncovering some pretty huge scoops lately. So how do you find the time to kind of balance between those two things? Like what's your strategy there?
The spelunking stuff usually comes to me.
Comes knocking on the door.
Yeah, it's hard to choose when to work on it because like a new beta comes out and as soon as I have a look at it, the better, because other people are also doing the same thing and it's always good to be the first one to release something about the new betas. So yeah, like I said before, if I'm working and the new beta comes out, I pause what I'm doing, have a look at the beta, like a general overview, and see if there's anything I'd like to investigate a little bit more. And usually in 1 or 2 hours, that's done. And usually there's nothing interesting, so I just go back to work. Some of this stuff that's coming out this week has been in the works for quite a while already. So it's like little hour, half hour of work here and there, or just like spend a night doing some extra hours to work on that. So that's fine. I usually the spelunking stuff ends up being inserted into my schedule by chance, basically, because it just comes up.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I can also imagine that it's similar to some of the things I do as well, where, you know, I might be working on a project and that might generate a lot of like side effects, that might generate lots of material for articles, it might generate some open source projects that I, you know, realize that, hey, I'm working on these three different projects and they all need this utility. Why don't I extract that and make that into an open source project? So sometimes you can see this burst, like we talked about on the last episode, I had this open source spree. It was just because I had been working on a couple of different tools at that point, and you know, those all kind of correlate at the same time, where, you know, it might seem like I just woke up one day and built a bunch of open source, but it happened over a long period of time.
Yeah, the same thing happened this weekend. I was designing a feature for Chibi Studio, and I was thinking about the way it was going to work. And it actually gave me a really cool idea of something I could use as an example for my talk I'm giving at NS North and App Builders, which is about security and privacy. And this feature will end up being an example I give during those talks, because it has some implications to security and privacy, and I think I found a cool, clever way to work around that.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that talk. It's going to be great, and I'm going to introduce you because I'm going to be emceeing the conference, so I'm really looking forward to do that. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
John the MC.
All right, so lots of exciting stuff going on, but what we want to do now is that we want to actually do one of our classic 8 months after release reviews, where we want to review the Apple Watch Series 4. So I mentioned earlier that I just got my Apple Watch, the Series 4, and that's because it was just this Friday, last Friday as we record, released the version with LTE was just released in Poland. So I was just now able to get it. And I've been using it quite a lot since then, like it's almost a week now since I got it. And I've been really doing a lot of experimentation with it, so I'm excited to talk about that. But why don't you kick us off? Because you've had this device for way longer than me. For you, like, what's it been like for you having this new Apple Watch Series 4? What's your thoughts about it now after using it for a few months?
I think the feature I like the most about the Apple Watch Series 4, especially compared to the Series 2 I had before, must be the speed. It's just really fast machine. It's amazing how fast it is. And the thing I use the most that is like a real time saver for me is the raise to speak feature, where you can just raise your wrist and speak and Siri will pick that up. And it's amazingly good at knowing when it was an accidental input. So it really only does that when I want it to. And yeah, it's a really good feature. I even use my HomePod less now that I have that, because I used to just scream "Hey Dingus" into the void,
and right,
my HomePod would answer. Well, one of my HomePods would answer, because of course I have more than one.
Of course.
But now I just raise my wrist and I say what I want, and it's usually a reminder or adding something to the shopping list or some timer for some thing I'm cooking. So yeah, it works really well for that, and it's amazingly fast. And being able to have short look content on your wrist, like a notification comes in. I have very few notifications enabled on both my Apple Watch and my iPhone. But for like iMessage, and which I have like very few people that I really talk to on iMessage, so I can have notifications enabled for iMessage. And when a notification comes in, I can look at it and see if it's something I should answer really quickly or if it's something I can ignore for a while. So yeah, it's a really good helper for your digital life.
Yeah, absolutely. The speed angle is definitely a huge one, because I was upgrading from a Series 0, like the very first one. And to be honest, I haven't been wearing it for the past couple of months because I've just been feeling like it was too slow, and I knew I was going to get the new one, and I thought I will also experiment a little bit with not wearing the Apple Watch for a while, just to see like what features I miss and, you know, how it will be like coming back to it after a while. So the speed is a huge difference, like actually be able to use it as a computer, you know, that is not just this like little gadget that takes forever to do anything. It's huge, like it's a game changer. And also the information density, like having that new screen, which fits so many more complications on the home screen or on the watch face, I should say. And actually just like being able to see more when you are reading a message or scrolling a list or something. I just find myself using the Apple Watch way more, and I'm able to get more utility out of it because there's just so many more things there. Like I can get almost everything that I need, like whether that's weather or my next meeting or you know, just launching a podcast from the watch face, like all of that information is available, and that just makes it so much nicer to use.
By the way, I think we should mention before people ask, which version of the watch did you get?
Yeah, sure. So I have the aluminium one, the sports version, I guess. And I also got this Velcro loop that comes with it. So I don't know what that's called.
Velcro loop.
Probably, yeah. So that's like the standard band that it ships with. So I didn't get any specific band, just the one with Velcro. And it's different because previously I had the sports band, the one that clips in. And I really like this one. It feels more light, the band itself. And I really like how you can easily adjust it to fit on your wrist. And I got the aluminium, like the white one, because I like this look better than the dark one. It's just personal taste. So yeah, that's my watch. What's yours?
So I initially I got the stainless steel one.
Oh yeah,
but that one died. Remember?
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, died a terrible death from some watchOS update. And I haven't been to the US yet. I'm going for WWDC, so I plan on having it be seen by the Genius Bar. And I don't know what I'm going to do with it afterwards. Probably going to sell it or something. But yeah, now I have the aluminium one as well. I love the way you said aluminium. and I have several bands. It's the space gray, of course. Everything must be space gray.
Yeah.
And it's the big one.
Oh, yeah, the big one too.
Yeah, I usually use the sport bands. I have the Nike one with the holes, mm-hmm. all the holes. And I have the black one, the white one, the red one. So I change them depending on the clothing I'm using. Or
oh, wow. My such a stylish person, such a fashion person. Yeah, I just wear the same one until it breaks and then I buy a new one.
I do that for shoes. I only have
right.
one pair of shoes.
Right.
But yeah, so I have those and I have the nylon one. It's a blue and white one. And I also have the Milanese loop, the black one, which is really nice.
Whoa, you have like a whole closet full of watch gear. Like that's a lot more than I have. I literally just have one band and one watch. So
yeah, I was like that for a while, but I ended up getting some more bands because I was kind of tired of using the same one every time.
Yeah. So I've been using this watch in some interesting new ways. So the people who have listened to this show for a while, you might have noticed that I like to, when I get a new Apple device, which, you know, admittedly, it's not that often. Like, as you can tell, I bought the iPad Pro, the last year's one, but my iPad before that was the iPad 3. And I usually go like 5 or 6 years between Macs, and now I got the Apple Watch Series 4, and the previous one was Series 0. So
meanwhile, I have 5 iPhones.
Yeah, you buy enough Apple gear, not only for the two of us, but for like a whole family. So that's, you've got the quotas covered. So when I do get a new device, I do like to kind of find interesting ways to use it. So the way I've done that with this Apple Watch is I have now, for the last couple of days or almost a week, every time I've left the apartment, I've just brought the Apple Watch, no iPhone. And even when I'm at home, I've just been leaving my iPhone on my desk. So walking around the house, I've just used the Apple Watch, going to the store, going for a walk with my dog, going out, all that stuff has been only with the Apple Watch. And it's not because I don't like the iPhone or because I think this is the only way to use the Apple Watch or something. It's just an experiment. Because by doing that, I can kind of also figure out what the watch is really good for and, you know, what use cases it really enables, but also what the limitations are.
There's another advantage, in my opinion, which is it also prevents you from being distracted by your phone
because absolutely.
The Apple Watch is way less distracting. And since it's more limited, you can do so much with it. You end up using it less and only using it for really important things or for checking things out. So this prevents you from like being on a walk with the dog and checking Twitter and checking your email or something like that while you're doing your walk.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely something that I really don't want to do ever. Like, I don't want to be this kind of person who is like always checking my phone and, you know, pull down to refresh in all the apps to see, is there something new here? Is there something new here? You know, like,
and don't forget to close them all afterwards.
Right, exactly. And boot them up from scratch again, right? So I have been leaving my phone on my desk for a kind of a long period of time now. And I've been really trying to, you know, be in the moment whenever I'm doing something. Like, I definitely don't want to be too distracted by my phone in general. So this ties into that for sure. But I found that, you know, for going on walks, for doing all kinds of tasks, the Apple Watch now, the Series 4, is extremely capable. Like, I took a walk and I was listening to a podcast. I was calling my mom directly from my Apple Watch with my AirPods. I was, you know, texting people, I was setting reminders, and now it might sound silly because, well, wasn't the whole point of me not bringing the watch to, you know, stay in the moment and not be distracted by technology? But these are all like extremely quick interactions when, you know, for example, I had a walk and I had an idea and I didn't want that idea to get lost. So rather than, you know, thinking about it over and over again to not forget it, I just raised my wrist like you mentioned earlier. And I made Siri make a reminder for me, and I made Siri make a note, and I was calling my mom as I was walking, you know, I do that sometimes, and all of the stuff from the watch, and at no point did it feel like I was jumping through hoops in order to get this stuff done. Like, it was all very capable of happening on the watch, which was really amazing to see.
Yeah, and how's the data plan situation there for you?
So it's really good, actually. Like, I got an eSIM, like an extra eSIM for my current subscription. So I was pretty lucky because I have a subscription with Orange, which is one of the major carriers here. And they are also the only carrier that has the Apple Watch. So that was a good match. And
nice.
It was actually pretty easy. You could do the whole setup on the iPhone. You just logged into your account. You clicked a few buttons to agree to spend a little bit extra money every month to get that eSIM. But then it just connected to my normal plan. So I think I have 10 gigabytes of data or something. It all just draws from that same pool of data. So it works out really well.
Yeah. And is it too expensive or is it reasonable? How much?
I think it was something like $1 or $2 per month. So,
oh, that's nice.
Yeah, reasonable. Definitely.
Yeah, definitely reasonable. Actually, you reminded me that I need to get a plan for my trip next week because I'm going to need data in Canada. So,
oh, yeah.
I'm planning on using one of those carriers that you can just download an app and they set up an eSIM for you.
Oh, yeah, that's perfect. The whole eSIM thing is just awesome. Like, I love that. But one thing I noticed in the setup flow was that, at least with the Polish version, you're not allowed to roam with this subscription. So my Apple Watch won't work abroad. And in the EU, we even have free roaming. Like, you can go to another country, like I can go to Germany or France, and I can use my phone as normally. Like, the roaming is free. But I don't know yet because I guess I will be able to confirm when I go to the conference in a couple of weeks. But so far, it seems like my Apple Watch cellular will only work in Poland.
There's an issue with the frequencies depending on where you are because the Apple Watch is not as global as the iPhone, I think probably because of space limitations and power limitations. So I can buy an iPhone in the US, which I do every year basically, and it will work very well here and it will have LTE and everything like that. But I can't use LTE on US Apple Watch here because it doesn't support the frequency that's used here.
Oh, I see. So that might be a limitation, yeah.
Yeah, there's like a physical limitation.
Right. But besides that, like, everything is really great, and I will keep up with this experiment. There are a few things that I've so far identified that I can't do on the Apple Watch. Like, I can't buy tickets for the local public transport on it, so if I'm taking a tram or something, I will need to have my phone or coins, but who has coins, right?
Yeah. And there's
a couple of other of those cases where you need a specific app, and this specific app does not exist on the Apple Watch, but maybe I'll be able to fill some of those holes myself by, you know, implementing something simple using some existing web API. I'll definitely look into some of that. But in general, I've just really been enjoying just going outside without the phone and figuring out, like, how to make the best use of the Apple Watch. And the battery has been holding up reasonably well, I must say. Like, there was one day where I was, like, running in the morning, like, working out. I went outside, like, 5 or 6 times during the day, and I had, you know, basically the watch was in standalone mode the whole day, including like tracking workouts and things like that. So during that day, it died before I went to bed, so the battery ran out, so I had to recharge it. But the other days, it's been completely fine. It's even been at like over 50% when I went to bed. And the awesome thing about the Apple Watch battery is that it's small, just like the AirPods. So it's super quick to charge. So you can just top it off, you know, if you are taking a shower or something, and you can get a reasonable amount of battery back.
Yeah, I could charge my Apple Watch every other day if I wanted to. But if I do that, then on the second day, it might run out at the end of the day, like at 8 p.m. or something. So I just charge it every night when I'm asleep.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so that's our Apple Watch Series 4 review. Great device, really happy about it. And let's see, I will report back when I find other ways to use it. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to hear what you think also, Rambo, going forward.
Definitely.
But now it's ice cream time. It's scoop time. Time for all the scoops. So it's time for the Rambo Report. So last week we had a pretty small Rambo Report, just a little bit of updates. But this week, oof. It's a big one. So Rambo, how do you want to approach this? You have posted 4 exclusive articles on 9to5 Mac with huge scoops about iOS 13, next macOS. There's sidecar rumors. There's new Find My Friends info. So we want to start from the top. Like, where do you want to start?
Well, I think we should start with iOS 13, since that's probably what people are most excited about.
Yeah, they just suffered through like a 20-minute segment about the Apple Watch for waiting for that. So let's give them something good.
So, John, iOS 13 is going to have dark mode.
Hooray!
Yay!
And I don't think I've told you this, but I've actually started using dark mode on macOS.
Oh, you're a dark mode convert.
I am, yeah. Once I realized that you could make Mail show still the light background, and some other apps where you don't need to have all the content be black, which was very confusing for me, I'm a dark mode convert. So I am actually genuinely excited about dark mode for iOS 13.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. Still not sure if I'm gonna actually use it on the entire system, but yeah, we'll see. And yeah, so as expected, it's going to be a system-wide dark mode. You're going to have the dock in dark mode, the app switcher in dark mode, all the notification pop-ups are going to be dark, and the apps are going to be able to adopt the new dark mode. Standard system controls are going to be dark, so it's going to be a really cool new feature. And it's also going to have a high contrast mode for people with a vision impairment, just like there's a high contrast mode on the Mac. And it's also going to be very good for apps that run on Marzipan on the Mac, because the dark mode from macOS is bridged to the Marzipan apps as the dark mode of iOS. I know that's kind
of
confusing.
Of course.
But yeah, but if you have an iOS app that supports dark mode and you build a Marzipan version that runs on the Mac, it's going to support dark mode on the Mac as well.
You know, now it really clicks for me. Like, of course there's going to be a dark mode in iOS 13. How couldn't it be, right? Because there's going to be Marzipan, and Apple wouldn't want all those Marzipan apps to be only in light mode. You know, when the dark mode was such a, you know, headlining feature in Mojave. So that totally makes sense that there will be a dark mode now. Like, now it finally clicked for me. You know, that makes total sense that those will be bridged.
Yeah, and we are also going to augment the reports here in this episode. I can say with a certain level of confidence that Marzipan is going to be a lot better than people are expecting it to be.
Awesome, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to probably have a report specific on that later.
Awesome. So let's do, like, next episode, we can talk more about Marzipan in detail, because I also share that belief with you that the production version of Marzipan, you know, besides the apps that we saw in Mojave, will be really, really a lot better. Like, it will have a lot more capabilities. So let's take that one as a separate big topic next week, because I think we have a lot of things to discuss there.
Definitely. So let's also talk about multi-window support.
Ooh, this is exciting. And I'm assuming this is for the iPad, right? We're not going to have multiple windows floating around on the iPhone.
Yeah, this is definitely for iPad. So, many people, they are confused by this. And I can say I'm also sort of confused, because this is a report not from something I saw, but from something I've been told about, so I can't, like, say for sure exactly how it's going to work and how it's going to look like. I only have the amount of detail that's been given to me, and what I've been told is that iPad apps will be able to have multiple windows, and they also have a new panel type of API that will open up as kind of like a sheet looks mm-hmm. like on iPad right now, but you'll be able to drag it around and stack sheets on top of each other and flung them away to dismiss them.
Nice. I think you also mentioned in your piece on 9to5Mac, the open source framework by our good friend Louis de Hauve, which is called Panel Kits, you know, where yeah. you can basically build some of these panels already. And it's getting a pretty common UI paradigm, especially for, like, more productivity apps, where they will have, like, some kind of UI popover. It will look like that, but then you can detach it and move it around. Because when you're drawing or working on a document or a presentation or whatever productivity tool you might be using, you don't necessarily always want to cover the same area of the screen. Sometimes you're working, like, on the top left part of the document, and then you really don't want any panels there, so you want to move them around. So making this a system-level feature, I think, is a good move, and I think it will really be beneficial.
Yeah, there's also something that's not mentioned in the report, but I've been told that these panels, the developers will be able to have them snap to certain positions. Mm-hmm. So let's say you have a toolbar, and it could be on the left of the screen or the right of the screen. So you'll be able to, like, throw the toolbar around. You're not going to be able to put it in the middle of the screen, but right. it's going to either snap to the left or the right. So there's going to be some control around it.
Yeah, it's kind of like how picture-in-picture works, right? Where yeah. you can put it in either of the corners, but if you flick it around, it just goes to the other corner, which I think is great. Like, that's a great UI, because it's very intuitive. You just flick it away, but then you don't have to micromanage exactly where it lands. Like, you can just flick it and it will go to the right place.
Yeah. And before we move on, since we're talking about multiple windows and it's kind of like a quote-unquote desktop aspect of the system, many people are asking about this rumored redesign of Springboard, which we mentioned with German a couple of episodes back.
Yeah.
And I don't mention it in my report because I don't have enough detail, but I heard that it is happening. So
cool.
There will be significant changes to Springboard on iPad, maybe even more than noticeable, like German mentioned during that episode. It looks like it's going to be quite significant.
Awesome. So do you think that one of those changes could be that you have one of these detachable panels or separate windows and you want to move it to, like, the home screen? So we talked about this on some previous episodes where wouldn't it be great if apps weren't just, like, siloed inside of this, like, full screen or at least partially full screen window where they are being rendered, wouldn't it be great if they could be more fluid, where you could say, okay, here is my iMessage window, and I want to take that and drag it onto the home screen and just make it persist there, like make the iMessage window be there on the home screen at all times, or build different home screens for different purposes. Do you think that this these window or panel approach that they might be going for, do you think that might tie into that as well?
Yeah, I think that's possible. Don't know for sure, but yeah, it's definitely a possibility that apps are not going to be constrained to being full screen or even just split view anymore.
Cool. So since this is the Apple News podcast where we are talking on, from a developer's perspective, more in detail, I also wanted to speculate a little bit how the API could look like, because one problem with this kind of approach on iOS is that apps on iOS are very centered around the app delegates. Like, it's this common joke that why don't you write the whole app in the app delegate, you know, because the app delegate has so many methods and it's so designed towards just being instantiated once and teared down once the app is terminated. And you have all sorts of APIs tying into that, like push notifications and continuity and handling URLs. It all goes through the app delegate at some point.
And the final implementation, at least in good, the decently designed apps, is usually you just take those methods in app delegate and just forward them to like a designated class that's going to handle like a notifications coordinator or something like that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Like, you make sure that you have these separate responsibilities. But even if you have like the perfect design, those calls still go through the app delegate. And yep, the app delegate is very much a, you know, an assumption about an app being this like one thing. So how do you think they will need to make some changes in order to support apps effectively having like multiple instances of the same app?
Well, I'm not sure, to be honest. I do know that it's probably going to be tied into the NS user activity stuff.
Okay.
Which is kind of the kitchen sink of iOS APIs.
Because, right.
Like, oh, we have a new thing. Throw it into NS user activity.
The only thing that's missing is that it's not called context, right? It should be called, if it was called context, it would just be the icing on the cake.
NS user context.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because it has so many things tied to it, like intents and opening URLs and continuing stuff with handoff and continuity and opening URLs and universal links and now even this stuff. And there's probably more stuff I don't remember. But
even
I
the classroom
like
stuff, right?
All yeah, the classroom stuff and class kids.
Yeah,
it's
all that stuff.
NS user activity.
The one API to rule them all.
Yeah. So yeah, and for the little panel thing, as far as I know, it's going to be a new presentation controller type.
Okay. So that's something that I could envision being like a presentation controller, like you say, or even like some variant of UI popover controller, where, you know, you could take your content view controller and put it inside one of those panels and it would quote unquote just work. But it's going to be interesting, like how multiple of those panels, how you ensure that the data doesn't get corrupted because the app assumed that, you know, there's only one viewpoint into this data. There's only one instance. Like, if we take this to the extreme, you could have like, you know, many, many different instances of the same app looking into the same database.
By the way, I should mention that I think it was a few months ago I tweeted about, you should make sure your app is able to have multiple view controllers of the same class on screen at the same time without each one corrupting each other.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. I mean, I'm not sure how it's going to work on an app level, but on a view controller level, that's fairly doable already. You can just make sure your view controllers don't share state with each other too much, so that if you have like two view controllers of the same type at the same time in memory or even on screen, they don't interfere with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also like, so there are two aspects to this problem. Like, the first one is to make sure that there's no like, you know, shared mutable state where one view controller or one screen, if we should, you know, try to also explain it to our non-developer friends, like one screen or one view controller mutating some data and then the other one like not getting those updates and then crashing because it assumed that the thing it's working on is still there. But the other aspect is to make sure that any changes get propagated, because you can't also build them as completely separate with completely like immutable data and nothing is changing, because that way you could have, let's say, take the iMessage example again. You bring out iMessage into your home screen. I send a few messages to you, and then I go back to the actual iMessage app. I expect those messages to be there, right? So you also need to make sure that the changes you make are propagated to all the different view controllers as well.
This reminds me of a bug I have with the new version of Chibi Studio, actually. Let's see if you can figure this out for me, John. Let's debug live.
All right.
So, Chibi Studio, when you launch it, it's a collection view with your chibis, all right? So you have the little characters, the picture there, and that's a preview of the character. And then we have a settings screen. And on the settings screen, one of the options the user has is to change their avatar, and their avatar is one of their chibis. Mm-hmm. So when the user taps their avatar, I bring up another instance of the same view controller that shows the chibis for them to select an avatar. Okay, that all works great. But when I select an avatar, it saves the avatar, etc. I close the settings view controller, which is on top of my collection view controller. All of my chibis from my collection view controller, they disappear. The items are still there, but the image preview of the chibi disappears. Can you think about why that will happen? I actually know. I want to see if you can figure it out.
All right. Thanks for putting me on the spot there, Rambo. So my
Let me help you, because I don't think I'm being
fair.
Well,
first, let me just make my... just from hearing your story, let me just say my top guesses, like where I would start looking first, because I actually think this is a super interesting situation.
Cool.
So the first thing I would look for is, for example, if you are reusing the same data source. So if you have like a data source that you are attaching to the first collection view, and then you're reusing that one somewhere else, you might have a problem where the first data source gets like dereferenced or deallocated, or you are putting it in a state where it doesn't no longer, you know, catch up. So that might be the first thing. The second thing would be some kind of like you putting it in an NS cache or something, and it would expire from memory because it would deem it like it doesn't need it anymore or something like that. Like if you are, for example, on view did disappear, you are clearing out some data or some cache data because you think the screen is no longer there since you're covering it with a modal, that model information will be gone. So those are two things I would start looking for, but now I want your am I getting close or am I off track?
Actually, you're fairly close.
Okay, that's great.
It has to do, actually, it's kind of having to do with both of them.
Okay.
What's happening is each image preview of a chibi on the collection view is a core animation layer tree. And this layer tree has to be generated from a model. So you have the chibi model, and it describes what the chibi looks like. And then it fetches the assets for each item, builds them in a layer tree. And that's kind of expensive, of course. So it's cached. So the layer trees are cached in an NS cache.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is when the second view controller comes up, it's using the same cache, which means it's using the same cached layer trees.
There you go.
And each CA layer tree can only be on one place at one time. It can be in two places. So I'll have to figure out a way to like copy this layer tree before putting it on screen, or having a separate cache for this other screen, or something like that. So that's the issue there.
So I was really close then.
And we completely derailed the reports.
Oh, but now I'm pretty happy because I was very close there. It was a caching issue. And I didn't consider that you would use layers and actually add them and, you know, move them physically from one layer tree to another one. So
yeah, that's not being done explicitly, but it is what happens if you have a reference to a layer tree and you just like add it as a sublayer to another layer tree. If it's already in a third layer tree, it's removed from the previous one.
Yeah, it's like taking one view and adding it as a subview to another view. It's the same principle.
Yeah, you can't just like, oh, put it in these two places at the same time. That's not how physics works in iOS.
Exactly. So tell me what's new in Safari.
Let's go back to the report. Yeah, so Safari is going to be smarter about asking for the desktop version of websites. So as many people know, some websites, when you load them up in a 13-inch iPad Pro in Safari, they load the mobile version, which is this iPhone-optimized one. Yeah. And that's not good. On a 13-inch iPad, even an 11-inch iPad, you can have the full web. You don't have to use the baby internet.
That's true.
Also, there will be a new undo gesture.
Awesome. Yeah, I read about this in your report. And at first when I read it, I was like, that sounds complicated. But then as I started, so the report is that there will be a three-finger gesture on the keyboard itself. So you put three fingers on the keyboard and you'll be able to swipe left and right to go back and forth through your undo history. So, you know, swipe left, I guess, to undo, and then swipe back to redo. But then I started like playing around with it, like just like putting three fingers on the keyboard on my iPhone. And I was like, this could be super nice. Like, so I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, and this what I heard about this is that it's more focused on iPad, so I'm not sure if it's going to be available on the iPhone as well.
Right.
Because the current undo gesture is to shake the device. And
yeah.
To be honest, on an iPhone, I don't find it that weird because
oh,
it's
I don't
a small
like it
device.
At all. Yeah,
yeah,
no,
I'm not,
not
saying I like it. I'm just not that upset by it on an iPhone. On an iPad, on the other hand, shaking a freaking 13-inch device on your hand, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, thankfully we have, speaking about keyboard shortcuts, you always have Command-Z, right?
Of course, and you can also use the little button that shows up on that bar above the keyboard.
Yeah.
Which is also helpful. But it looks like, from what I heard, that this is going to be very focused on being this interactive undo. So you'll see exactly, it's like you're scrubbing a timeline. So you'll be able to do that. And it's also possible that this will be available to us developers to adopt in our own apps. So let's say the Chibi editor in Chibi Studio, I can add this interaction to my canvas view. And scrubbing left with three fingers will go back in time through the progression of building the chibi, and you can scrub right to go back to where you were. So I think that's the focus here. It's this interactive aspect.
Yeah, I think probably like this will be built on top of Undo Manager, which already exists and already lets you do some of these things already, where you can register different actions that you're performing with the Undo Manager and enable users to undo them. So even if you're not just dealing with built-in classes like UI text field, for example, which has undo built in, if you're building like a canvas or something like a picture editor, you could actually use Undo Manager to implement some of these things. And hopefully it would work out of the box with this new API. But of course, the current version is just going back one step. So you're shaking the phone, you're going back. And with this, it would probably store a lot more data, which could also have some considerations in terms of memory. Like, if you're storing your entire bitmap in the Undo Manager, that could quickly grow in size. So it would also require you to do a little bit of like diffing and maybe store actions and mutations instead of storing raw data. So it's going to be interesting to see how we can implement that as third-party developers.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting gesture that they're working on. And there's also going to be font management on iOS, proper font management.
Nice, not just like the current iteration, which requires you to install like third-party apps that bundle specific fonts, and then you get them through a, you know, some kind of certificate or something like that.
Yeah, you have to install a profile, which requires you to enter your iPhone passcode, which for me is a pain because it's a really long alphanumeric passcode. So yeah, not great. So they are working on a proper font management system.
Awesome.
You'll be able to manage your fonts in settings, and there will be a standard system UI to warn you about missing fonts when you open a document and you're missing a font on the system. And there's also going to be a font picker component, view controller for iOS developers to use in their apps.
Excellent. That's great. Yeah, this is another just unlocking another feature, another aspect of the iPad Pro specifically, where, you know, if you want to work on in Keynote or something, you bring your presentation over from the Mac and you don't have those fonts. It's a big pain, right? If you don't do that third party app approach. But this sounds also amazing to me.
Yeah. And speaking of productivity, there will be a new gesture for selecting multiple items in collection views and table views.
Cool. So besides the kind of drag and drop gesture where you just like tap additional items to pick them up?
Yeah. So what this sounds like is that you'll be able to do kind of like clicking and dragging in Finder, where you can basically draw a selection.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it will look like, apparently.
Maybe Apple watched my prototype that I did.
Yeah, could be.
Where I used the Apple Pencil to circle in things.
Yeah. So I'm not sure exactly what the gesture is going to be, but let's say it's like dragging with two fingers instead of one. That's perfectly doable in like a big collection view or table view.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we also have new API for third-party apps to have document collaboration, kind of like the iWork suite of apps does.
Nice. That's super cool. And that will enable people to build more easily these like Google Doc style editing where you have multiple users editing the same documents?
Yeah, because we do have CloudKit sharing, which basically it allows people to share records. So it can be like, let's say we have some sort of item in an app. Let's say it's a reminders app and we have a shared shopping list. That's very easy to do with CloudKit at the moment. But this interactive real-time collaboration that we see in things like Pages, which we use for the show notes, by the way, and works very well for us.
Yeah.
That's still not very easy to do for third-party developers. So it looks like they are trying to make that easier for third parties.
Awesome.
And I think they are probably going to be opening up private APIs they've been using and dogfooding for their own apps. I hope what they're doing.
It seems to be their general design process. Like there is,
which is great.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's how it should be, really. Like you build an API, you try it out for yourself for a year or something like that, or even 2 years, figure out all the bugs and the edge cases and things like that, and then you make it a public API once it's more polished. That way you can be more confident that the use cases that you will cover are more realistic ones. And while I don't keep my own utilities private for like a year or two, that's also my personal design process. Like the open source projects that I make, they all come from code that I've been using myself in my own projects, but then I'm opening it up to everybody. And honestly, also my articles come from that as well. Like techniques I've been using for maybe a year, 2 years, sometimes even multiple years. And now I feel like I know enough about them to write a good article about them.
Yeah, and another thing to come with iOS 13 is going to make me very happy, particularly, which is a pet peeve of mine, which is when apps don't use the proper status bar style. So you'll see sometimes apps that have like a dark navigation bar and they didn't bother to change the status bar color to white. Mm-hmm. So you'll have like black text over a dark background. And it's usually non-native apps that do this. There seems to be a trend with non-native apps tend to not care about the status bar style, as they don't care about many other things as well. But I digress. But there's still a problem. Like if you open up Slack on an iPad, especially in landscape mode, and this is not their fault. It's like there's no way to fix this really. The sidebar is dark, but the main content window is light. And this is a pattern in many apps, actually.
Yeah.
So you have like the time on the top left corner is going to be too dark because the background is dark. And it's going to be correct for the other side. So you have that problem. And they are fixing this by allowing each side of a split view controller, which is what these apps use, to have a different status bar style associated with them. So each half of the status bar is going to have its own style.
Nice. Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah. It's a minor change, but I'm sure it was tricky to implement, and it's a nice attention to detail.
Yeah, because again, we have edge cases, right? Like what happens if you decide that the split view controller should go all the way to the right? Like if one view controller occupying 90% of the screen or vice versa, you know, that way you could end up with weird situations where the wrong view controller will be deciding the status bar appearance.
Yeah. And there are other minor changes, depending on your opinion, but like there will be a new Reminders app, which has basically been the same since, I don't know, iOS 6 or something.
Yeah, it still feels like kind of skeuomorphic, which kind of, you know, you still like have these almost like bundles or folders of reminders that look very much like, you know, things you swipe around and things like that, so... I guess they could also modernize the design a little bit to feel more more modern.
I think it's the only Apple built-in app that still uses the background effect where it'll have like your blurred wallpaper as its background, which was like a huge deal on iOS 7, and it's not anymore.
Yeah, because even Wallet doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
It's all white now.
The calculator used to do it as well. I think maybe phone still does it. No, not even phone. So yeah, they quickly changed their mind about that.
Yeah, totally.
And also, John, a new volume HUD.
Finally, right?
Finally.
Yeah, finally my iPhone is not screaming at me when I'm changing the volume.
Yeah. And it sounds like what it's going to look like is the left ear of the notch on your iPhone with a notch will show you a little volume indicator, kind of like what Instagram does.
Yeah, I've seen some apps do that. Like they capture the event and they display their own control instead. So
yeah, I do it in Chibi Studio.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I use the for the version that's not out yet. It's going to be in beta soon. We have cancel and done buttons in the editor, and the cancel button is in the left ear of the notch, and it flips over and becomes a volume indicator when you're changing the volume, which is kind of cute.
You know, this is why this app is taking so long to produce, because you're like literally like rewriting system behaviors and making animations between buttons and volume controls. And I do admire attention to detail, but yeah, Shibi Studio new version coming soon, trademark.
Yeah. How many hours did I spend on that transition?
Oh, yeah. Do we want to know?
No, we don't. And also the whole tutorial system I wrote.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I shouldn't be the one talking, right? Like I'm the person who like, "Oh, I want to build a new website. Let me write a string parser."
Let me write a Swift tokenizer.
Exactly. Yeah. That's me. Cool. So iOS 13 is really building up to be an exciting feature, but there's a couple of different things that you've uncovered as well, and one of them is that there seems to be a desktop extension feature in macOS, which enables you to bring certain windows with you on the go on your iPad. Kind of like there's different third-party tools that do this, like Luna Display, which enables you to use your iPad as like a secondary display. But this seems to be like a built-in new feature. So what is Sidecar, Rambo?
So I've been told that the little green... full screen button we have on Mac Windows, it's going to have this little menu that pops up. Apparently, when you hover over the button for a while, it's going to show this popover, and it's going to list some options like putting the window full screen, tiling the window to the left, tiling to the right, kind of like something you can do in Windows, where you like drag the window in a certain way and it snaps to a side of the screen.
Yeah.
It's going to also show you your external displays you have connected to your Mac, and it's also going to show you your iPads.
Super cool. And what will you be able to do with it? So once you press the green button, you select your iPad, it moves the window over there. Like what will you be able to do with it? Will you be able to pick up your iPad and leave the house? Or what's the constraints there?
I haven't been told exactly what technology underlies this, if it's AirPlay or if it's screen sharing or if you're going to have to connect your iPad physically to your Mac, which is a possibility. Maybe you'll have to connect it with the cable. It's possible. But apparently this is going to be more like something like Duet Display or Luna Display, where your iPad basically becomes an external display. But you'll have to be probably in the vicinity of your Mac to be able to use it.
Cool. So yeah, you can't take your Pages document. That's a bad example because you have Pages on iOS as well. But you can't take your Photoshop. Chrome window or Photoshop and put it on your iPad and go to the park.
Yeah, exactly. And another cool feature of this is that apparently you're going to be able to use the Apple Pencil to manipulate the content of your Mac app through these external iPad displays. So it basically becomes like a Wacom tablet.
That's super cool. And I think like all of these different pieces that we're talking about now, like Marzipan, we're talking about this new feature and, you know, all these different things, they kind of tie together just to form a more uniform system. Like when you have iOS apps running on the Mac and then you are broadcasting that iOS app back into iOS and then you are drawing on it on your pencil, like it really comes full circle. And it, for me at least, it shows this little glimpse of the future, of a bright future, where all the apps and everything, they're kind of just built on this same foundation where they can just be moved and communicate with each other, and you can use whichever tools you want, whether it's a mouse or an Apple Pencil or whatever, to work on them, and they all just work. And wouldn't that be great, right? And it feels like this is another step in that direction.
Yeah, it's taking handoff to a whole new level, if you think about it.
Yeah.
So handoff, you can, if you have the same app on both platforms, you can hand off content from one machine to the other. But that's just like handing off some context. There's the word again. there you can pick up where you left off. But this is like moving the entire thing over so you can work on it.
Yeah, and isn't it funny that handoff, to just top it off, it's also built on NS user activity.
Exactly. I don't know, maybe this external display is as well.
Maybe the next version of iOS is going to be NS user activity OS.
Yeah. You know,
everything is in there. Oh, that's super cool. I'm looking forward to this. Like, I haven't used any of these third-party solutions yet. And a long time ago, I used some app that enabled you to use your iPad as a secondary display. But usually I work in front of a big screen, but it would be really cool to be able to just go to the couch and, you know, bring a window with me without having to do the full handoff thing, or if you want to use an app that doesn't exist on iOS.
So, Sketch.
Yeah. Sketch is a great example, actually, especially like being able to use the Apple Pencil and things like that. There's a ton of possibility here, and that would be really cool.
Yeah, and to complement the article, I heard that this is not going to be exclusive for the latest and greatest iPad Pro. This is going to work with other iPads as well.
Nice. That's very good. The next thing that you've been writing about is also one thing that I think a lot of people are looking forward to, and that is a big event in the history of Apple computing in general, the big breakup of iTunes, right?
Yay.
Where it seems like it's finally happening, where iTunes is going to be, you know, maybe breaking up is the wrong term in this phase of the project, because it's more like adding additional apps that you can use instead of iTunes, right? But instead of having everything only being usable in iTunes, like Apple Music and podcasts and things like that, there apparently will be some new standalone apps for this. So could you give us a rundown of this report and what are the different apps that you think we'll see in the next version of macOS?
Yeah, so basically Apple is going to be including a new music app, a new podcasts app, the TV app, which we heard about already from Apple, and also the Books app on the Mac is going to get a significant redesign. And I see some people freaking out over this because, oh my God, I use iTunes, I rip my CDs, and I like to edit metadata in iTunes and things like that.
Who likes to edit metadata in iTunes?
You're right, but some people do, apparently.
If you do like to edit metadata in iTunes, if that's one of your hobbies, then I have a recommendation. Maybe try to find a new hobby.
It's like collecting postage stamps or something.
Yeah, that's better. Like, go collect postage stamps. That's way better than editing metadata in iTunes, I promise.
Yeah, so also I heard some people who have podcasts that when they finish exporting an episode, they move it into iTunes to set the metadata. But they should really be using Farcast, which is a great app by Marco Arment. It's a free app. So you can just go to Overcast. I think it's overcast.fm/Farcast.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, you just download it and it works great. It compresses the file beautifully. It warns you about long silences. You can add the chapters, add pictures. We use it for this show and it's awesome. So yeah, no need for iTunes as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, that wouldn't even occur to me. I didn't even know you could do that. Like, you know, I wouldn't use it as a podcasting editor, right? So yeah, much better to use more lightweight versions for that.
John, the metadata editing UI in iTunes looks like a Boeing cockpit. Like, there are so many controls and options there. I don't know. I mean, that's probably why in the iTunes terms of service, they have like, don't use this to control nuclear plants.
You can do that using the metadata.
Yeah, it's possible. It's in there somewhere.
Right.
So iTunes is not going away. It's still there. It's still usable. You can still edit
your metadata.
Yeah,
relax.
You can still edit your metadata. So don't worry about that. But I am very happy about this because I am an Apple Music subscriber. I moved to streaming a long time ago. I started with Spotify. And when Apple launched Apple Music, I decided to try it out. And it works great for me, so I ended up canceling my Spotify subscription and moved everything to Apple Music. And I am a very happy Apple Music subscriber. I don't need to manage metadata. They do that for me. I do understand that some people have like very niche collections and stuff that they use, but there's still iTunes Match and the iCloud Music Library. I don't think that's going away. I doubt they would release a music app on the Mac, remove iTunes, and not give you a way to import your own stuff into your iCloud Music Library. I don't think that's happening at all. And maybe even this music app is going to be more powerful than we think. We go directly to the conclusion that it's going to be just the iPad app from music running on the Mac as a Marzipan app, but that's not necessarily the case. So that's something I think we should wait and see. I am more optimistic than most people. And I'm also very happy about podcasts on the Mac.
Yeah,
but
totally.
I'm looking forward the most to having a Marzipan version of Overcast on the Mac, which is the app I use.
Yeah, same here. But it's always great. Like with podcasting, I really don't have any like allegiances to any specific app. I mean, I use Overcast. I think that it's a fantastic app and I use it personally. But, you know, I think you should be able to use any podcast player that you want because that's the beauty of podcasts. That is literally an RSS feed with some MP3s. You download it into any client that you want and you can just listen to it anywhere you want. So for the people who do use Apple Podcasts, being able to have a dedicated app for that on the Mac will be huge, right? And yeah. I think that will just be awesome to have that.
Yeah, and I actually would love to be able to use Apple Podcasts, but I tried it, and yeah, Overcast is so much better.
Yeah,
I would love to be able to use it because of this ecosystem integration, like with the Watch and HomePod, but yeah, it's not great.
Right. I think this is, in general, a great move, and it's something that, like I mentioned, we've been anticipating now for many, many years, like that there will be these dedicated apps, because that's just the way things are going in general, it feels like, to have these more specific apps that do slightly less, but they do it better. So to have a music app that is just great for streaming music from Apple Music, having a great podcast player, rather than shoving all that stuff into the same application. And I think that would be great. And you mentioned also that you think that Books app will get a major redesign. That leads me to thinking that Do you think that there will be some underlying technologies that all these apps will share? For example, the structure will be the same in many cases, where you will have some kind of storefront, like even if podcasts are for free, you will have some kind of, you know, UI to browse the podcast catalog, you will have a way to search Apple Music, you will have the iBook store, etc. So do you think that they will not only like share classes, but do you think they will be built, you know, on top of the same framework?
Yes, those apps are built on top of the Apple Media Services
context.
APIs. Yeah, so they, but yeah, they have like several frameworks that are shared between those apps, and yeah, they all build on top of the same foundation. And
cool.
They're probably going to share UI components as well. So yeah, they do build on top of a common foundation.
Nice.
It's really interesting how they work, actually. They download like an XML file from Apple servers on startup, which kind of like configures the app and defines which tabs show up and what type of content the app consumes. It's very interesting.
Cool. That is a great fit for content-driven apps like that. And for those people who have been following my work for a while, back when I was working at Spotify, might know that I was a huge proponent of this design, where I gave talks about it at conferences, etc., how we were at Spotify building the app in the same fashion. We were using JSON, not XML, but you would get a JSON file and that would configure the entire UI. And that is great for content-driven apps because it changes all the time, like every day pretty much. Like you want to have different recommendations, you want to maybe, you know, turn on and off features depending on things like time of day or locale or some A/B tests that you might be running, or there's so many different things that can influence what content gets displayed. So having that be completely dynamic from the server just enables you to do things like, you know, here's this new podcast that just launched without having to update the app or, you know, add this new component. It's all just like configurable from the back end.
Yeah. And to be fair, they are not using XML per se. They're using the property list formats, which
right.
is
yeah.
easier to work with than raw XML.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome. So we do have one more scoop left there. The ice cream is not over yet. We have one more serving left. And it's about Find My Friends and Find My iPhone. So all your favorite friendly tracking apps are being updated, unified. What's going on here, Rambo?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting report. And this there's one thing about it that's the most interesting, and it's not about the apps, but we're going to talk about it in a bit. But the basic gist of it is that Apple is going to be revamping the Find My Friends and Find My iPhone apps, which haven't been getting that many updates lately, but they're now going to become a single unified app. So all features of both Find My iPhone and Find My Friends will be available in a single app, which makes sense.
Like yeah.
They do similar things. They find stuff and you can set notifications for when stuff is in a certain place. So yeah, it makes sense.
Perfect. And speaking about stuff, it also sounds that it will be able to track other stuff.
Yeah, you're going to be able to track your stuff. So by the way, we should mention that the code name for this unified app is Green Torch, which I find kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I've also been told that there's going to be some AR involved.
Interesting.
Not sure how it's exactly, but yeah.
Maybe we can show you where your car keys are by just like holding up your iPhone to your living room. It's like, oh, they're under the couch.
Well, that
big,
is a
big
possibility.
Arrow pointing.
Yeah, it's a possibility. So they are working on a new device, a brand new category of device even.
Oh, wow.
And it's known only as B389. That's the internal model name. And it's a tag-like thing, kind of like these tile things you can attach to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you pair it to your iPhone, like AirPods, and it becomes associated with your iCloud account. And then you can configure like for you to be notified if you get away for it too much. Like, let's say you're forgetting your wallet at home. When you're like leaving, it can like tell you, hey, you're forgetting your wallet. And you can also add some certain locations to ignored locations so that you can leave your things there without being notified. And you can also share the location of your items with friends or family through the app. But what's even better, and I think this is like really, really cool if it works, is that you'll be able to put your item into lost mode, just like your iPhone, if you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And if another iPhone user gets nearby your device and approaches it with their iPhone, they will be able to see your contact information you set for that particular tag to be able to tell you that they found it.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Because when you first hear about a feature like this, it might sound a little bit gimmicky, right? Like,
yeah,
you put a tile like that on your car keys or in your wallet, and you're like, oh, great, now I can track my wallet. Oh, it's in my pocket. Well, mystery solved, right? But like you say, like, there are so many situations where even if you're not using it, it's not one of these products that you use every single day and you're like, oh my God, it's this cool device.
It's an insurance policy.
Yeah, exactly. When you do need it, like when you, if you do lose your wallet or your car keys, or you can't find the Siri remote for the Apple TV because your dog kicked it under the couch, you know, those kind of things can be super useful, right? And it's kind of almost like you're indexing your real life, right? Like you're really letting the computer have an index of your physical stuff.
Yeah, and this is, now I'm extrapolating, I haven't heard this, but this could very well be the case. But imagine if, let's say, you, John, you lost your wallet and you put it into lost mode using this new app. Then I am walking by and I see a wallet and I notice that it has one of these tags. I approach my iPhone to the tag and it says, oh, this is an item that's been lost. Tap here to say you found it. And I tap it. You get a notification that I found it. And then we can start a private iMessage conversation without me knowing your phone number, your name, anything. Or you knowing me. Because that's a problem with lost items sometimes, that they'll find some identifiable personal information depending on who finds it and will start like blackmailing you or something like, oh, pay me and I'll give it to you.
Send me some bitcoins. Yeah.
Yeah. And in general, like you don't want the random people getting access to your phone number and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a, I really see a good potential here, especially given this crowdsourcing of location between all devices, because there are so many iOS devices out there that, yeah, this could be a huge deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that comes to mind is that you could potentially use this, depending on how they expose this to users, but imagine being able to tie like a shortcut to one of these tiles. So you could say something like, always run this shortcut when this tile goes out of range. So you could then use that to build your own little home automation without being a programmer. You could like stick a tile on your door or something and then say, you know, when I leave this room, automatically turn off my music or something like that, you know? I think that could be really powerful just to be able to like really bridge the physical and the digital world.
Yeah, really nice. I'm really excited about it. As usual, the disclaimer that this is an unannounced, unreleased product that leaked, so this could very well never see the light of day. But
yeah, it could be just a prototype, right?
Yeah, could be another AirPower.
Right. You know, one more thing that comes to mind here is that what if the big gotcha about this feature, if it comes, would be that, guess what? The Apple Card, the credit card, is also a tile, right?
Ooh.
That you get automatic tracking of your wallet if you have the Apple credit card inside of it.
That would be neat. Yeah,
it would.
That would be
really
cool. Yeah, so I'm really excited about this product, and I hope it does see the light of day.
Yeah,
by the way,
too.
Fun fact, the fact that it starts with B could mean that the same team that worked on AirPower works on this.
No. All right. I don't know
That's
what we want to read
reassuring.
Into that. Right. Well, hopefully they've learned their lesson, right? And they are ready for new challenges. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt.
Well, they aren't pre-announcing it. So if they end up never releasing this, I'm not going to blame them because it's not right. their fault.
That's true. So lots of great scoops this week, Rambo. You've been really on fire. It's been really cool to see all of these things coming out. And yeah, keep up the good work. So we have so many things to talk about on the show. This is really, really awesome. I think you've been keeping the entire podcast world busy this week with all these reports.
Yeah, I want to publicly apologize to Mike from Upgrade because he had to throw away all of the show notes they had for this Monday's episode. But at least they had time to prepare.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so really great stuff. We'll, of course, discuss some of these things in more detail on future episodes as we get closer to things like WWDC. And we also, like we mentioned earlier, we want to do a special, big segment on Marzipan and what we think and our expectations are for that. So stay tuned for all of those things. But what do you say, Rambo? Should we round off this episode by answering a Ask Stacktrace question?
Of course.
Awesome, let's do it. So just a quick reminder that you can send us any question you want. For example, if you want to hear us more talk about some specific topic about how we work as indie developers or productivity or coding things or whatever you like us to talk about.
Our favorite pasta.
Yeah, our favorite pasta, whatever floats your boat, send us a tweet. You don't have to mention anyone specifically, just use the hashtag AskStackTrace, and that will just go into our little collection of questions, and we'll pick out a question for each episode, and we do try to answer as many questions as we can, so please send us questions. We really, really appreciate it. But this episode's question that we have now comes from Matt. And Matt wants to know, as a 10-year web developer who has mainly focused on things like HTML, CSS, JavaScript, etc., where's the best place to start to learn Swift, specifically for iOS development? So, Rambo, why don't you kick us off? Like, what would you say are your go-to sources that you would recommend to people if they want to learn Swift and iOS development?
That's the million-dollar question there.
Right.
We both get asked this many, many times, and it's very hard to give one answer because it kind of depends on the person's background. Like for Matt's case, he's been working with web development for more than 10 years, as he mentioned. So he knows HTML, CSS, PHP, JavaScript, and he mentioned that he also knows TypeScript. He is the type of person I would suggest to just download Xcode, create a new project and play around with it, because he should be able to do that at least initially, since he's got so much experience with so many other technologies. But as a general, I always suggest people going to iTunes U and looking up whatever the latest edition is of Stanford CS193P, which is a free course they make available on iTunes U. And it's taught by a great professor, and he's worked at Apple, has many years of experience. And they always have, I think, two editions per year. So you can usually find an edition that has like all the latest iOS version and Swift version. And it goes through like the main aspects of building an iOS app. And some years they vary, like some years they teach core data, some other years they teach CloudKit. So you can also go back some years and look at other APIs. But it's like a general, it doesn't teach you like much about architecture and things like that, but it does teach you how to talk to iOS APIs and the main concepts like delegation and the app lifecycle, all of that stuff is covered, auto layouts, all the basic things, and you can go through the course fairly quickly.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a great recommendation. I do love that Stanford course. It's really, really good. And like you also mentioned earlier, like just diving in and trying things out and experimenting with stuff like Playgrounds is really great. That's how I personally learned Swift. Sure, I had at that point many years of iOS development experience and Mac development experience using Objective-C. So picking up Swift was easier in that regard. But just trying things out, I think, is a great way to learn, especially if you're already a programmer. You know, Swift is not that different syntactically from something like JavaScript. It has a lot of similarities, although it's more strongly typed. So I think you're going to appreciate that. But just trying things out, I think, is a really good thing, like learning by doing.
Yeah, and this is the answer for Matt. So it wouldn't apply like to someone who wants to get started with programming doing iOS stuff.
Right, then exactly.
The answer would be very different.
So I want to expand on that and recommend some resources that I think are really good for beginners in general. Like, I know Matt here is not a beginner, like been programming for a while, but beginner in Swift, right? So I will just recommend a bunch of different resources, and hopefully for our listeners, those will be good depending on your skill level. So I'm going to recommend four different publications that publish, or four different publishers, I should say, that publish great books and other content about Swift and iOS and other topics related to, you know, development on Apple's platforms and with Swift. And I also want to just make a little bit of a disclaimer here that two of these are sponsors of my work. So the first one that has sponsored my work is Ray Vendelik, and they are doing lots of great tutorials for free on their site. They also have lots of great books on their store.
I love their website.
Yeah, it's really great. Lots of great tutorials, and you can really learn how to build specific things, like specific like animations or using specific APIs or building an app from scratch. There are lots of good tutorials there. So if you're looking to get your hands on with some of those specific APIs and getting guided through in a tutorial manner, then Ray Vendelik is a great site for that. Another publisher, which is also a sponsor of mine, I just want to say that because even though I recommend them fully, you know, by myself, and they didn't pay me to say this at all, I just want to, you know, make that disclaimer so you know. And that one is Manning. They are also doing lots of great books on Swift specifically. They have a big bundle with lots of Swift content where you can learn things like algorithms. They have specific advanced books on Swift. They have beginner books on Swift. So they have lots of different things that are more focused on Swift as a language. And there's some iOS content there as well. And then we have two other publications that are not sponsors, but I still recommend them. And the first one is Objective-C.io, a really great site run by my good friend Chris Eidhoff and his coworkers. And it's at Objective-C.io or objc.io. And they have books like on app architecture. They have books on advanced Swift, and they have a bunch of other things. They also have a video show called Swift Talk that you can check out.
I love that show.
Yeah,
I watch it.
It's really, really
week.
Good. Yeah, it's awesome. So you can check that out if you're more into video. And then the final publisher is our common friend, Paul Hudson, who runs Hacking with Swift, another great series of books. He also has a huge amount of content on his site for all skill levels. So he has, for example, a Swift in 60 Seconds video series, which goes through different techniques about Swift and learning Swift from the beginning just in 60 second video. So that's really, really great if you want to just dive in and learn something very specific, or you want to read one of his articles or buy one of his books. He also does live streams, you know, he's crazy. He does everything. So definitely check out his site.
I actually want to plug his live streams because I've been following them for a while now. And if you want to see what it takes like to build an app from scratch with Swift in like 2 hours or less, his live stream series is really good. Like, he usually takes like a project that can be done in like an hour and a half or something, and he just goes through and builds an app live on stream. So that's like a good way to have an idea of what the workflow looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I also want to recommend two other video-specific pieces of content or people you can follow. And the first one is another common friend of ours, our friend Ben Sherman, who creates NS Screencast. It's a really good video series with screencasts about all things Swift and iOS development and Mac development, all kind of things. And we've both been guests on his show as well. So I did a two-part video there with him on Swift scripting. And I think you did something also about Mac development. Is that right?
Yeah, we've actually done a couple live streams on his YouTube channel. So those are free for you to watch. You can search for them. We've done about AppKit.
Great. Perfect. And then the final person I want to recommend is Sean Allen. He does lots of really great stuff on YouTube. He has a show called Swift News, which is coming out every Monday, where you can get a good kind of up-to-date review of what has happened in the last week in the Swift world. And he also does a bunch of tutorials on YouTube as well. So those are also really great for people who are just getting started.
I also want to recommend this website called Swift by Sandel.
That's a good recommendation. I was just waiting for you to say it, right? Because I can't say it myself. That would just be obnoxious, right? So yeah, once you've gone through this and you've like built yourself a good kind of basic understanding of Swift, then you can definitely check out my site. I will say that I don't post like beginner content so much. I have a new series called Basics. So there's swiftbysandel.com/basics, where you can read about more like basic concepts and shorter articles. But in general, I write articles that are assuming that you have at least some familiarity with Swift. So that's why I'm careful to say, like, go to swiftbysandel.com directly, because if you're not familiar with Swift, you will most likely be a little bit confused by my site. But once you have built that, you know, good foundation of knowledge, then definitely make sure to check out my site as well, because I publish a new article every single week, and there's probably going to be at least something there that will be interesting and useful to you.
Awesome.
Great. So that's a good segment, I think. Lots of recommendations. And as you can see, like, I love the fact that there are so many people creating content in this community. And I also want to point out, like, I don't see any of these people that I recommended as quote-unquote competitors. Like, we are all creating content for different audiences and different people. And as you can see, you know, I'm super happy to recommend all of these different content creators, because I think they're all doing a great job. And I do love that all of us that are creating content for the community, we can do it in different ways. And it just makes, you know, everything better for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So that's our Ask Stacktrace question for this week. Again, if you want to ask us a question, just tweet with the hashtag Ask Stacktrace, and we will pick it up for a future episode. Another thing you could do while you're on Twitter and while you're tweeting your hashtag Ask Stacktrace questions, why not recommend our show? Like, if you like listening to the show, if you've been following it for a while, recommend it to some friends. Maybe tweet about it or send a message to someone, you know, to ask them to check out Stacktrace, because we do love when people do that. It's not only because we want to grow the audience or something, but seeing people share the episodes we make and recommend the show is also super motivating for us as we are making it, because me and Rambo, we're sitting here and I'm in Poland, you're in Brazil, you know, we're talking into a microphone here, but it's super nice to hear back from people on the other side, right? To see people share and see people talk about the show. So feel free to do that, and we really, really appreciate it.
There's also the recommend button in Overcast, the little star button.
Exactly. We're going to sound like YouTubers now. Hit that little star and then hit the little bell to get notified of new episodes. Yeah.
Remember to like, subscribe.
Exactly. All right. But that's it for our promotional messages. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. You can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. Mr. Rambo is at @_inside. And that's it for this episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.